True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
A Florida woman saw the state patrol car's lights flashing behind her, and she wondered why she was being stopped. She didn't think she was speeding, she later told investigators, but she pulled her car onto the southbound shoulder of Interstate 95, and she waited as Trooper Tim Harris approached her car. Trooper Harris asked her to get out of her car. Then he saw that she was obviously pregnant. He gave her a warning ticket for driving 6 miles over the speed limit, and he let her go. Police would later speculate that the woman's pregnancy saved her life. The next woman pulled over by Trooper Harris would not live to see another day. Lorraine Hendricks' car was found abandoned on the highway, and detectives suspected that someone she trusted was involved in her disappearance. Trooper Harris was seen as trustworthy. He had actually been with the Florida Highway Patrol for 8 years. Before that, he'd also worked for local police departments, and he'd earned several commendations. He was a married man with 2 young children, but a closer look would expose a very troubled man. Join us today for A Darker Shade of Blue, the terrifying story of a man who was called upon to serve and protect, but turned into a very dangerous predator.
So today's beer is a beer from Tampa. We've been to this brewery because we visit Tampa frequently to visit our daughter. This one is from Angry Chair Brewing, called Barrel-Aged Imperial German Cupcake Stout. Got all that?
Sounds good.
It is. You would call this a dessert beer.
Like German chocolate cake, is that?
Pretty much.
Yummy.
So it's jet black, dark brown head that disappears pretty quickly, just leaves a little ring around the edge. Wonderful aroma and taste. Cocoa, coconut, vanilla, bourbon, a little bit of some roast. Coffee type of stuff. Translates nicely into the taste. It's pretty sweet. It's a thick, chewy beer.
Chewy, I love it. Let's open it up.
We will, and we're going to share. There's a whole crowd here tonight. They all want to try some of this stout.
All right. Well, we're lucky that we found a spot at the Quiet End because it is a busy night, a beautiful day today, and people are out.
People were out and around today. That's
yeah,
for sure.
Absolutely.
It's been a nice day.
But I think we can earn our spot by sharing some of this delicious beer.
I know we can. They'll love it.
Okay. So why don't you go ahead and start our story today, which is really terrifying. It's changed the way that I behave when I drive, actually, a bit.
It sure is a terrifying story.
It's terrible.
So Fred and Pat Wessendorf moved from upstate New York to Florida in the 1950s. They were a young couple, and they had a baby boy named Martin. And over the next several years, they had 3 daughters, Kathy, Susan, and Sandra Lynn. Fred worked for the Vero Beach Press Journal, and he and Pat supplemented their income with a paper delivery route, stocking newspaper machines in the early morning. Pat was the energetic and outgoing one in the marriage, and their youngest, Sandra Lynn, family called her Sandy, she was a lot like her mother. The Wessendorfs worked hard to raise and support their 4 children. They lived in the house that Fred's dad had owned. It's a small house, but it was on a big lot full of trees and gardens. When the 3 girls got older and needed more space, Fred built them a place that the family called the dormitory, out in the back of the main house.
And these girls were all very pretty. 2 of them married policemen, Susan and Sandy. Their brother Martin moved back to New York, but the Wessendorf's daughters all stayed close to home. Kathy and her husband raised kids and exotic birds and pets. Susan worked at a bank, and Kathy and Sandy eventually worked for the same real estate and investment firm. Every Thursday, Pat and her 3 girls met for lunch. Susan married Don Dappin, who became a cop when he was just 20 years old. He was a stocky, muscular guy, very friendly and confident, and he made detective at the very young age of 23. Sandy met her cop when she was still in high school. Sandy was only 16, and Tim Harris was 21. Tim was already a police officer in Sebastian, Florida, the tiny town where Sandy lived. Sandy was accompanying a girlfriend who was seeing Tim's partner on the force, so Sandy ended up sitting and talking with Tim for a couple of hours. The next time she saw Tim Harris was on Sunday, January 14th of 1979, a little after 11 p.m. That's when Sandy and her girlfriend were driving out near the airport, and they heard a siren and saw flashing blue lights in the rearview mirror. The young policeman who walked up to the driver's side window was Tim Harris. He was smiling, and Sandy thought that he was probably the best-looking guy she had ever seen. He had soft brown hair, big green eyes, and Sandy was a popular girl, so she had plenty of boys to choose from. So for her to think that meant something. Now, she'd never considered dating an older man, but she was starting to think about it when she met Tim.
So Tim says to her, "Miss," he was kind of semi-serious, "I'm afraid I'm going to have to arrest you. You violated a municipal ordinance. I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to write you up for violation of a 916.83, resisting an officer."
Yeah, so he was acting businesslike and he filled out a ticket on his clipboard. Sandy answered his questions, giving him her address, her height, and her weight. And she saw him writing down blonde for her hair. And he had a smirk on his face as he filled in under eyes pretty instead of an eye color. So this was his way of being flirtatious, his way to pick up girls, really.
How cool.
I don't think it's so cool, but we can get into that.
Being a little sarcastic.
There. I know, but I think it was a little bit creepy from the beginning.
It would give me the creeps.
He tore a copy of the ticket off and handed it to her, and he said, "You'll have to comply with the instructions there at the bottom." And Sandy read what Tim had written. "Resisting this officer, but we'll fix that on 1-15-79 at 7 p.m. at City Hall. This officer is off duty then, and maybe Sandy would like to go somewhere without Cindy." So yeah, he's totally picking her up, like almost forcing her to. It's gross.
Well, it gets worse. He explained that she would have to report to headquarters, or the arrest would stay on her record.
But she knew that wasn't true.
Yeah, she did. So she didn't show up at the police station the next night.
I give her credit for that.
Well, for a time.
It helped her a little.
Tim didn't give up so easily, however. 4 days later, he pulled Sandy over again as she was driving through town. Now, this time, he refused to return Sandy's driver's license after he'd asked to see it. He said, "I'll be writing reports later at the station, and you can come pick up your license, and we can talk."
Yeah, so this has to be against the rules. But he was good-looking, and he thought he could get away with this stuff. If she wanted her driver's license back, Sandy did have to go down to the police station. So she did, and she spent some time with Tim then. But she didn't agree to a date with him. She believed that he was too old. He was out of school, he was an adult, and she was still a high school junior. She wasn't ready to be tied down to some serious relationship. And it wasn't that Tim frightened her, though. He really didn't, because he was a local boy. And he told her that he'd graduated from high school in 76, not that long before. He'd been a track star, and he'd excelled in the hurdles and the cross country. So he was popular, athletic. He didn't seem creepy, other than this kind of weird method he had of picking up women.
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, this is in the 70s, so we're 40 years ago. Maybe it was kind of more acceptable then. But geez, I would just have all sorts of red flags going off if I was Sandy and this guy is hitting on me the way Tim was.
Yeah, because he was purposely pulling her over because he wanted her to go out with him. And let's not forget, she's 16. That's really young. She's not even an adult.
Right.
And all Sandy knew about his family was that his dad had an important job at Cape Canaveral, and his mother had a successful career as well. Sandy probably said no to Tim on multiple occasions, but he kept showing up. And every time she was out, there he was. And women did not reject Tim. He had his sights set on Stacy and on Sandy, and he thought he deserved her.
So she eventually stopped avoiding Tim and agreed to meet him on a quiet road in her town of Sebastian. He was on duty, but he asked her to meet him by parking her car behind his. Now, her parents certainly wouldn't have approved if they had known about their 16-year-old daughter's romance with a 21-year-old guy. But by then, Sandy was infatuated, and every time she saw Tim, her feelings for him grew stronger.
When Tim finally came to Sandy's house and was introduced to her family, he did come across well. He was very polite. He looked very put together. Sandy's father liked Tim, Her mother, Pat, wasn't so easily impressed. But Pat had always been very protective of her children, especially her daughters. And she never did become totally comfortable with Tim. There was just something about him.
Trust your mother.
That's right, if you'd only listen to your mom. She recalled the first time that she met Sandy's new boyfriend, and she said Tim was weird. He was always creeping around, she remembered. She told the story about one time when she heard the doorbell ring, but when she went to answer it, nobody was there. And Tim was hiding in the shrubbery beside the house. Sandy said it was because he was shy. But he was a grown man and a policeman, and it struck her as really odd that he would be playing games like that. And he was always like that, kind of creeping around, hiding, and he liked to jump out at you. Now, let's stop at that comment, jumping out at you. Green River Killer, Ted Bundy.
We've heard this before.
A lot of killers enjoyed jumping out at women and scaring them.
Right.
Yeah. So, there's a red flag for you.
Well, he rings the doorbell and then jumps in the bushes and hides. I mean, that's...
It's weird, isn't it?
That's just... No, to me, it's beyond weird. But that's the way Tim Harris behaved.
Yeah, I guess so.
He'd walk around the house, his head down, like he was brooding about something. Nevertheless, Sandy fell more and more in love with Tim each day. Now, part of it was that she was very flattered by his persistence. It made her feel special. He would not take no for an answer, and he left her no time to see any other guys.
She's a 16-year-old high school girl, and this handsome policeman thinks she's the best thing ever and gives her all this attention. I think any young girl would be flattered by that.
Any high school kid, yeah.
Yeah.
Young.
No, I think a lot of grown women wouldn't be so flattered by it. But he was very handsome in his uniform, there's no denying that. The high school boys that Sandy knew looked like children compared to him. And unfortunately, as soon as Sandy showed her love for Tim, though, that's when he changed. He turned on her. For the first weeks that she dated Tim, she believed that they were going steady, even though he tormented her by flirting with her girlfriends. He seemed very shy, in a way, but he was always coming on to other girls. And of course, that was embarrassing for her. But he didn't even seem to care that it bothered her. In addition to flirting with her friends and ignoring her feelings, Tim was not dependable at all. Sometimes he showed up, sometimes he showed up hours late, and sometimes he didn't show up at all. He would tell Sandy that he'd been out of town to visit his mother. And Sandy would always wait by the phone for Tim, which her mother hated that she would do that. She hated to see any man treat her daughter with disrespect, and she didn't really approve of this one anyway.
No, she didn't. And not just disrespect. I mean, you have to look at her daughter and say, you know, what's wrong with you? Why are you so subservient to this guy?
Exactly.
Jeez.
Not good.
But Sandy defended Tim, and she always made excuses for him. One thing she didn't know was that Tim was dating another girl just as much as he had been seeing her. Tim's unexplained absences finally grew to a point where Sandy confronted him, because his excuses were just unbelievable. Sandy asked around town and learned that the other woman was a pretty college student. She attended Auburn University just across the Alabama border, and she called Sandy, this woman, and told her that she and Tim were going steady. How are we going to tangle with a college girl?
Well, I think she was very intimidated by that. And when Sandy confronted Tim with this, he did admit that he was seeing someone else, but he claimed that it wasn't serious. He said that he was trying to break up with this other woman, but it was complicated. And both of these young women were very deeply in love with Tim, and neither one of them were going to leave him. And Tim seemed to love that. He liked being wanted by these two young women and kind of toying with their emotions.
So after Sandy learned that Tim was engaged to the college student, she and her sister Susan drove to Auburn, and the visit made 17-year-old Sandy feel very miserable. The other woman was wearing an engagement ring Tim had given her, which she showed to Susan and Sandy, and showed her wedding gown and bragged about the wedding plans.
Well, there ended up being no wedding for Tim and his fiancée back in August 79, but Sandy did finally break up with him. She wouldn't talk to him or see him. She felt like she couldn't trust him. But that August, Hurricane David left about 1,000 people dead in the area, and it ended up bringing Sandy and Tim back together. Tim called Sandy and told her he just had to be sure that she and her parents were okay. Now, by this time, it had been 3 months since she had talked to him, but Sandy had secretly wanted Tim to come back to her. But he was still seeing the other woman. He was juggling both relationships, and he was lying to both women. So even though he had this other woman, he had to have Sandy back. He just couldn't be rejected by anyone.
Interesting. So he's engaged to this other woman. They have a wedding plan that never comes off, and they stay together.
Yeah, he kept seeing them both. I think the engagement was called off, but he didn't stop seeing her.
Nope.
That Christmas vacation in 79, the other girlfriend dropped out of college and moved in with Tim. Keeping him was apparently more important to her than her education, and Sandy was crushed. She would have done anything to make Tim happy, and she was putting up with his lies and cheating, hoping that he would come to his senses and just be with her. He bought Christmas presents for both of them. He told Sandy he would break up with his live-in girlfriend, and he was openly cruel to this girlfriend. He'd invite Sandy over to his apartment while the girlfriend was there, and he seemed to enjoy rubbing it in her face that he was bringing this 17-year-old over. So it's getting very dysfunctional.
Yes, isn't it?
So this girlfriend lived with Tim for 6 months, and then she finally had enough and she moved out. She told her co-workers that it was almost a relief to be done with him. She had showed up at work many times before with bruises, but she would never admit how she'd got them. When she was away from Tim finally, she did seem like a happier person, and no one saw bruises on her anymore. So she really dodged a bullet there.
I think so. So by this time in 1980, Sandy had won Tim Harris for herself.
Big prize.
Looking back, she probably thought winning Tim was not such a victory for her, because life with Tim was never easy. When they did get back together, Sandy was much less trusting of Tim. He had betrayed her too many times for her to ever forget. She tried to believe him when he apologized, because she wasn't the type of person to hold a grudge. And she couldn't stay angry with him. After all, Tim was her soulmate.
She loved him. Well, from the time he was in junior high, Tim had always had a girlfriend. He stayed with each girl for a year or two, and then he was always the one who did the breaking up and moved on to the next girl right away. Sometimes this even overlapped, where he wasn't finished with one girl, he was already on to the next one. But the thing about him was he would never let a woman reject him. If one of them tried to leave him, it would be a big drama, and he would try and fight to get her back, and then set it up so he was the one who eventually did the leaving. With Sandy, he would never accept her decision to leave him. There was something very wrong with Tim's feelings about women, apparently. While he flirted and charmed them, there was a part of him that disrespected and maybe even hated women. Men who knew Tim recognized his contempt for women. Male co-workers reported that they would be driving down the street, and Tim would hang out the window and call a woman a slut, or make obscene gestures at her. It was just beyond inappropriate. This is a grown man, a policeman.
Well, he's a piece of work.
Yeah, you could say that.
Now, Tim had always wanted to be a policeman. When his parents divorced, he lived with his father and stepmother in order that he could graduate high school and stay in the town where he knew people who could help him get started in law enforcement. He had always been a good worker. Although his father, George, had a good job as a draftsman working in the space program, and his mother, Virginia, worked as an executive secretary, Tim was one of six kids, big family. They grew up near Washington, D.C. in Alexandria, Virginia.
That's not a cheap place to live.
No, not even back then.
So with six kids, it would be expensive. Tim was actually born in April of 1958, and he was their second child. These were all good-looking kids with brown hair and blue-green eyes. In 1965, George and his wife, Virginia, Tim's mom, moved their family to Satellite Beach, and that's where George had accepted the job in the space program. Tim worked during summer vacations and school breaks, usually at Disney World in Orlando. The summer after he graduated high school, he worked as a busboy for a restaurant in Disney World. That fall, he took community college classes that he hoped would help him get a job as a policeman, because that was the goal. In January of 1977, Tim was sponsored by the Satellite Beach Police Department to take the basic police training course at Brevard Community College. Tim finished the course in April of 77, and he couldn't find a police job right away, so he joined the U.S. Army Reserve, and he attended military police school until that October.
Now, his counselor at Brevard Community College wrote a letter recommending Tim to the mayor of Melbourne Village, Florida, as a good candidate for their police force. So in November of 1977, Tim was hired as a police officer for the Melbourne Village Police Department. Melbourne Village was a tiny town in Brevard County with a police force of only two or three officers. There wasn't much to do there. But it was the beginning. Tim was on his way. He wanted to become a Florida highway patrolman.
But at this point, he was only 19, and he was a cop. He was voted Melbourne Village Police Officer of the Year while he was there.
Well, if there's only two or three others, he would have had to have some time.
That's right. The awards just got passed back and forth among the two or three guys. So Tim was the only one on the force who hadn't gotten that honor when he got it, so it was just kind of bound to happen.
Yeah.
Wasn't anything special like it might sound. And actually, the police department was concerned about reports it received about Tim Harris. There were allegations that Tim was using his badge and his status to stop young women, sometimes taking their licenses, so they would have to meet him to get their license back.
Oh, he learned his MO early.
So that's what he'd done with Sandy.
Yep.
Also, Tim had allegedly arrested a motorist for having an expired temporary tag when there was a valid tag in the back seat, but he just kind of lost his cool and overreacted. Also troubling was that Tim drove the squad car very fast and recklessly. So he was given three choices. He could resign from there, he could be fired, or he could be put on probation. And Tim chose to resign. But still, the police chief gave him a glowing letter of recommendation, which, looking back, we could really criticize him for that.
Well, we've done a few cases of this. Michael Swango comes to mind. People kept writing glowing letters.
Yeah, just kind of passing the buck.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think from their standpoint, you're right. If they write something less than laudatory, shit can come down on them.
Exactly.
So let's avoid all that trouble. We'll just say he resigned and he was a great cop.
Yes, but he was actually a dangerous man.
Already. And here he is, what, 19, 20 years old?
Yeah, he's young. But I guess their excuse at this point was, oh, he'll outgrow it. He's just young.
Sure.
But with each new job application, Tim explained that he had resigned from the department because he was very unhappy with the department, explaining that they didn't live up to his professional standards. So since the Melbourne Village Police Department soon closed down, whatever problems Tim had there were just forgotten, and he had a clean slate anyway. For a while, he worked installing aluminum doors and windows, and he told this employer that he didn't plan on staying with them for long because he was going to have a big career in law enforcement.
Then in 1978, Tim got his job with the Sebastian, Florida Police Department. Sandy was due to graduate high school in June of 1980, but she didn't have to attend school for the last 6 months because she already had all her credits. So she's working in the public supermarket in the bakery. She was good at managing her money, and she saved as much as she could. Sandy also came to a conclusion fairly quickly that Tim was not very frugal. He lived way beyond his means. There was always something he wanted to buy. So he didn't smoke, drink, didn't do drugs. So it seemed okay that he wanted to buy things. He wanted to own his own home. Since his parents had divorced, Tim had never felt he belonged anywhere. Every once in a while, Tim would let Sandy think they might get married someday. She wanted to believe him, but she still didn't trust him.
Things were going really well between Tim and Sandy in the beginning. She knew he still flirted with other girls, and she suspected that he sometimes did more than that. But she really loved him. This was her first love. And if Tim had some wild oats left to sow, she decided she'd wait around for him to grow out of it. She just really wanted to be the woman who would be there when all the others were gone and would be his lifelong love. One day, Sandy was visiting Tim at his apartment when she answered the door, and a hysterical young woman, a waitress from a local restaurant, rushed in and said that she was pregnant with Tim's baby. Sandy didn't say anything, but she pointed toward the bedroom where Tim was still in bed. When Tim saw this crying waitress, he pulled the covers over his head and wouldn't face her. When she left, Tim started to cry, and Sandy asked him some questions about when he had slept with this woman. But he obviously didn't know anything about pregnancy, because it was too soon for her to even know if she was pregnant. So it was either a false alarm, or this woman was making up a pregnancy to get Tim's attention. But Tim was relieved, and Sandy, once again, forgave him. Tim was the first guy Sandy ever had sex with. He would be the only man for many years. The first time she slept with him, she was just 17, and she was very disappointed. There was no foreplay, no kissing, no loving words. He just threw her on the bed and had intercourse with her. And she hoped that their sex life would improve. But she wasn't the type who would ever complain, so she didn't say anything to Tim about it. I imagine the kind of guy Tim was, he really wouldn't take it well. not very open to constructive criticism.
Probably not. So in the summer of 1980, Tim began to talk more seriously about marriage. This time, though, Sandy wasn't ready, and she tried to stall him. She wanted to be sure of him before she committed to him for life. She believed, probably wrongly, that Tim would be faithful once they were married, but she didn't want to rush it. Tim, at the same time, had become dependent on Sandy to manage his life.
In the late summer, Tim found a small house in Sebastian Heights. It wasn't fancy, but it was new. It had about 900 square feet of space, and it had a little garage. Tim was making about $16,000 a year, and he didn't have the down payment on the $46,000 asking price. But he was installing some lighting for a contractor, and he managed to buy the house without a down payment. So he had a mortgage, he had truck payments, a Sears card, and a MasterCard. So Sandy helped him. She took over the management of his finances, and she also shared her money with him. So it was Sandy who made sure the mortgage was paid on time. But the problem was, Tim soon got bored with his new house, as he had a tendency to do. It wasn't big enough, and he wanted things desperately, until he got them. And then things and people began to lose their appeal to him. He always needed something new and something more in order to be happy. So even when he got something, he didn't feel satisfied for very long.
Nope, there's always something better around the corner.
Yes, which he didn't have the money for. They're already overextended, just paying for the house, the truck, the cards,
So in December of 1980, Tim and Sandy went out together and picked out her engagement ring. Sandy picked a date in April for the wedding, but then they settled on July of 1981. In their wedding pictures, they looked happy. Despite the fact that he was handsome and photogenic, Tim hated to have his picture taken. He smiled for the camera, but behind her back, he was pinching Sandy hard to let her know he was not happy. And their sex life didn't get any better after their marriage. For their honeymoon, they drove up through Georgia and North Carolina for Tim's brother's wedding on the following Saturday. They saw the Smoky Mountains and Chimney Rock. On their road trip, it seemed to Sandy that they really had a clean slate ahead of them. Tim would be faithful, they would have babies, and they would spend the rest of their lives together.
So during the honeymoon, they stayed with Tim's family in West Virginia, which was pretty uncomfortable for Sandy. Tim's mother, Virginia, and one of his sisters had driven to Florida for Tim and Sandy's wedding. So Sandy met her new mother-in-law for the first time on the day before her wedding. So it was difficult to spend 4 days of her honeymoon with people that she barely knew. In the family wedding pictures, Tim's right arm was behind Sandy. He was pinching her, but of course the camera didn't show that part. Sandy thought it was really weird that she knew next to nothing about Tim's family. He didn't talk much about them, and when he did, he was very negative, especially about his mother and his stepmother. He was especially angry that his father had divorced his mother, and he blamed the stepmother for that instead of his father. He had lived with his father and stepmother until he graduated from high school, but for some unknown reason, he was no longer welcome in their home. Sandy never found out why. The only time Sandy ever met Tim's father was at her wedding, even though they only lived an hour away. So very strange.
Very, isn't it?
There's a lot going on behind the scenes there that we just don't know about with Tim's family.
I know. So one of Tim's lifelong dreams came true in February of 1982. He applied to the Florida Highway Patrol for a job as a trooper. The Highway Patrol put applicants through multiple physical, mental, and psychological tests. Tim filled out forms asking about his life, his family, and his former jobs. The Highway Patrol did background checks on Tim and his family, and they didn't find a blemish on anyone's record. Florida Highway Patrol investigators talked with Sandy's and Tim's next-door neighbors on both sides. And at that time, thanks to Sandy, Tim had an excellent credit rating. He listed his debts as $34,000 to Gulf Atlantic Mortgage for the house, $250 to Sears and Roebuck, and $150 to MasterCharge. No late payments on the record.
Yeah, so he was hired, and he was very thrilled. He resigned from the Sebastian Police Department and prepared to attend the Florida Highway Patrol's 65th Recruit Training School, which began that May of 82 and finished that August. So this meant that he had to leave Sandy for 3 months while he was up at the state capitol in Tallahassee. That summer was one of the most romantic times in their marriage, according to Sandy. While he was living at the Highway Patrol Academy, Sandy drove the 16 hours round trip to see him every other weekend. She had a full-time job, so she couldn't leave until Saturday to go see him, and she had to return again on Sunday. So that was a lot of driving, but for her, the drive was worth it. During these times, he seemed more romantic, more attentive to her, than he did during any other time during their marriage. And maybe it was the separation that made him act nicer to her, I'm not sure.
In the Florida Highway Patrol's class, recruits went to class each day from 8 to 5, 5 days a week, and most of Saturday. Intense classwork.
It was a very intense program.
They learned how to preserve evidence, how to lift fingerprints, and how to interview and interrogate suspects and witnesses. There were radar and other speed measurements devices to learn how to use. Tim's main interest in law enforcement was traffic. He did very well in criminal investigation and criminal law, and things happened to work out well for them. So when he completed his training, he was assigned to the Fort Pierce District in nearby Vero Beach, close enough that they didn't have to relocate.
Which was the exception, because most of the troopers did when they started out. So they kind of had a favor done for them by people they knew.
Sounds like.
Some things didn't change, though, as Sandy hoped they would after they were married. Because Tim wasn't interested in socializing with other couples, he would go fishing sometimes with another trooper. And he and his brother-in-law, Don, were both cops, so they played cards with Don and Susan once in a while. Tim didn't drink at all, though. He actually seemed to have an aversion to alcohol. And people who knew him would say that they think it was because he didn't like to lose any kind of control of himself. He always liked to know exactly what he was doing, although lots of times what he was doing was not great. I mean, he had definitely had a temper, so I wonder if alcohol would have made that worse.
Probably.
Might have been a real mean drunk if he ever got drunk. But even when they were dating, Tim had used some physical force to control Sandy, and he continued to do that in their marriage. He would twist her arm behind her back if she said anything he didn't like, or he'd pinch her at the top of her thighs between her legs, which really hurt, but nobody could see it. He wanted everything done his way, that was for sure. He had to have the newest and best car, the biggest boat, and all the newest technology. And he would beg Sandy to buy him whatever it was that he had to have, like she was the mom and he was a child. Sometimes Sandy gave in and sometimes she stood up to him. She had managed their finances and she knew what they could afford and what they couldn't. She'd been with Tim for 3 years by then, and she knew that he got bored with each new thing. And then he would want something else. Very frustrating.
Yeah, it was. Besides frustrating, it was a problem. Sandy made about $15,000 a year. Tim made a little over $22,000, so they couldn't afford a new car, a new boat, a new house, or a new baby on their income.
Yeah, and then Sandy got pregnant, and Tim seemed happy about the baby, but he thought that Sandy should still do everything the way she did before she got pregnant, lifting things, working two jobs, and of course having sex whenever he wanted. Sometimes she couldn't do all that he expected of her, and he was often annoyed and cruel to her. There was no question about what they would name the baby either, because Tim had decided for himself before they were even married that if he ever had a daughter, her name would be Jennifer Lynn, and a son would be Timothy Jr. These were the names that he had picked out for his children, and Sandy had no input at all. And she continued to work full-time as a secretary and to deliver morning papers on a 2 a.m. route. She worked in an area where there were apartment houses, and she had to carry two heavy sacks through the entire route of 600 customers. That was heavy work for a pregnant woman.
No kidding. And on the morning before their daughter Jennifer was born, Sandy asked Tim to drive her on her route. When they got home, he was mad at her because she was uncomfortable, and she didn't know whether she should go to the hospital or not. By the time she realized she was in labor, she was in pain, and Tim did have to drive her to the hospital. When they got to the emergency entrance, Tim drove right by to the parking lot. He was still mad at her and told her, "You're gonna walk, bitch."
Can you imagine that?
I love you too, honey.
So their baby, Jennifer Lynn Harris, their daughter, was born just 5 hours after they arrived there. And Tim refused to go into the labor room. But he did seem proud of his daughter after she was born. Sandy rationalized staying with Tim because he didn't drink and he worked hard and she thought he would be a good dad. But also, no one in her family had ever been divorced, so she really wasn't considering that divorce would be an option for her, no matter how unhappy she was.
Tim's brother-in-law, Don Dappin, thought Tim was pretty strange. They were friends because they were married to sisters and because they were police officers. But Dappin felt Tim was a loner. Tim loved boats. He loved to catch drunk drivers. Besides those things, it was hard to find anything to talk to him about. One thing he did know was that Tim literally hated women. Once, when Tim came home after working a fatal accident, Sandy noticed that the tragedy didn't seem to affect him at all. Sometimes he'd come home and say, "We had a really good accident tonight. It was neat."
So that's bizarre.
Very.
But Sandy continued to keep her marriage problems mostly to herself. She actually felt like she was doing something wrong. Tim liked everything to look perfect on the surface, and he would have been really angry if she told anyone about their problems and he found out. So they wanted a bigger place. They bought a plot of land and built a 3,000-square-foot house. And that was after she talked him down. He actually wanted to build a 6,000-square-foot house. Not much income.
Yep.
But he was able to do most of the work himself. But then as time passed and they lived in this new home, he lost interest in it, and the house kind of fell into disrepair because he didn't want to fix anything anymore.
Yeah, and then in 1987, Tim put in a request to work as a canine officer. This would involve getting a dog and be sent to canine training in Fort Lauderdale. So he was excited when he was given orders to report to canine school. His dog was named Shadow. Tim spent weeks training his dog. He built a pen for Shadow out beside their new house. Otherwise, his duties didn't really change. He still investigated accidents, made DUI arrests, and wrote speeding tickets.
Right, because he was waiting for something to come through where they would do more work with the dogs, and I guess that never really happened.
But he's got a cool dog.
Very nice looking dog, but kind of an intimidating dog as well.
Sure.
Yeah.
Why don't you tell our audience about our sponsor today?
Are you in need of new earbuds or headphones? Check out tweakedaudio.com. Tweaked Audio earbuds and headphones come in 8 styles and 6 colors. There are mic'd and non-mic'd versions available, all designed for great-sounding talk, podcasts, audiobooks, or music. All Tweaked Buds are compatible with iPods, iPhones, and Android devices, and they all come with a lifetime warranty and free shipping. As a True Crime Brewery listener, you can get 33% off your purchase by using our promo code BREWERY. That's tweakedaudio.com, TWEAKEDAUDIO.com, and promo code BREWERY.
Okay, back to the story. We're going to talk about Tim Harris's victim, Lorraine Hendricks.
So Lorraine, she was born in Stamford, Connecticut, to Frank and Jody Dombrowski. Frank was a career army officer, so the Dombrowskis moved often. When Lorraine was 5, they lived in Germany. By the time she was 17, they were living in Baltimore. And in between, they lived in several different posts. Lorraine was a talented swimmer, and she earned her senior life-saving badge when she was 16. Lorraine was very pretty, too, and she won beauty contests. She was Miss Stamford, Connecticut in 1967, and then first runner-up to Miss Connecticut. She had a real talent for languages as well. She went to the University of Connecticut, and she became fluent in French, German, Spanish, and Polish. Now, if she hadn't been so nice, she may have made other women jealous. But she was very nice, and she wasn't at all conceited.
Lorraine loved little kids and animals. She was adventurous, and she would try anything once just as long as it didn't go against her own moral code. She was a drummer in a rock and roll band for a while. She climbed mountains, swung off them on ropes, and she tried parachuting.
Much more adventurous than I am.
Well, maybe when you were 20, you were like that too.
No, I wasn't.
Okay.
Lorraine was one semester short of graduating from college when she dropped out, and she married John Boiseau in 1977. She was so happy with him. John wanted to be a professional musician, and they lived in the Miami area for 10 years. She was very attractive, like I said, so she modeled for a while to help support his ambition. But then Lorraine and John divorced after 11 years together. Lorraine would later say that they gave up too easily and they could have made the marriage work. But after the divorce, both of their careers really took off. John joined a locally successful band. He owned a soundstage and rented out musical equipment. Lorraine spent 14 years in Fort Lauderdale, working as a promotional marketing executive. She was full of good ideas, and she enjoyed being around people. After being single for 2 years, she met Rick Hendricks, an executive with Eastern Airlines, and a captain in the Army Reserve. Lorraine fell in love with Rick, and they were married just 6 weeks after they met. So that was a quick courtship.
Certainly was. So Lorraine was in her 30s by then, and she was wanting a family. When she was 38, she became pregnant. and in June of 1984, she had a baby girl she named Catherine. She took a sabbatical from work until Catherine was old enough to attend school. Lorraine cooked her grandmother's recipes for traditional Polish dishes and would prepare an Easter feast like her ancestors had served in Poland. She also worked with Polish families who had immigrated to help them set up their households in America.
In 1988, Rick Hendricks was offered a job as an executive with Blue Cross, but he had to relocate the family from Fort Lauderdale to Jacksonville. It turned out that Lorraine and Rick had very little in common, except for their love for their daughter, Catherine, and they started realizing that after a while. Lorraine was a very physical woman who enjoyed the outdoor life, and in the beginning of their marriage, they had done those types of things together. But then Rick started putting all of his energy into his career. He liked to stay home and relax on the weekends, and Lorraine was bored. They did try to make the marriage work for their daughter Catherine's sake, but they eventually did file for divorce. When Catherine was almost 6, Lorraine opened up her own PR firm in Jacksonville. She called it Lorelei Promotions Limited. Then it was in May 1989 when Lorraine met a new love. Suddenly, she's in her 40s, and her life is seeming to change for the better. Her career was expanding, and she was in love. Neither Lorraine nor this man knew if their relationship could continue to be as perfect as it seemed in the beginning, but her friends would say she was giddy like a high school girl. Around this same time, Tim invited Sandy out for dinner. This was September of 1989, and Sandy was surprised and excited. But this evening was brutal, and Sandy would never completely get over it. It was to have been a birthday celebration for Sandy. Tim would be working a night shift on her birthday, so he told her they would celebrate early. They hardly ever went out in the evening together and hired a sitter, so it was kind of a special occasion. But their food had just arrived when Tim said, "I think you should know I'm seeing another woman." Sandy was taken completely off guard because she knew that Tim flirted, but she hadn't even considered that he might be having an affair. She thought he had been faithful since they got married.
Yeah, so after Tim broke this news to Sandy, he expected their marriage to go on as usual. But Sandy was obsessed about this. She needed to know the details of the affair, even though she was dreading the answers. So Tim finally confessed everything, and Sandy was shocked to learn that he had been having this affair for 4 years. Sandy kept her failing marriage from her family, hoping still that there would be some way to save it. She knew that once she told her mother, her mom would never forgive Tim. Now, Tim promised her that he wouldn't see the other woman anymore. Sandy didn't believe him. Well, we've heard that story before.
Exactly. So why would she believe him?
Right.
But he did agree to try marriage counseling.
He promised that he was no longer cheating and that he wanted to make his marriage work. But it turned out that he was lying to both Sandy and the counselor. And it didn't take long for Sandy to find out that Tim was still seeing the other woman as much as ever. One night, Tim was called out by the dispatcher, but his patrol car was being repaired. He told Sandy he was going to drive his truck to another trooper's house and borrow his patrol car. So Sandy waited a few minutes, and she called the other trooper and asked to speak to Tim. Of course he wasn't there. He was out with the other woman.
So she finally filed for divorce after that incident, and this was late November of 1989. Tim really freaked out, though. He was shocked that Sandy would actually leave him. He begged her to change her mind. He had really treated her like shit, but now that she was leaving, he suddenly couldn't live without her. In his mind, Sandy actually belonged to him. She was more of a possession than a partner in life. And Sandy was a really beautiful woman, but Tim finally seemed to realize that. He was obsessed with controlling her. Susan and Don Dappin knew the situation, and they tried to mind their own business, but Tim was really getting scary. He was jealous of Sandy, and he lost his mind when he realized that she was not going to take him back. Don had seen men who would rather see a woman dead than let her go, and this is what he was seeing with Tim. He'd never thought Tim was normal to begin with, and now his behavior was very unpredictable. Don worried about what Tim might do next. He hoped that Tim's career as a cop, which had always been really important to him, would keep him from doing anything crazy.
One would hope. Then on December 9th, 1989, Tim's obsession reached a new level. Sandy's sister Susan had invited her to go to the Uptown Lounge in Vero Beach with her. It was a Saturday night, and Don was working. Tim followed Sandy and Susan to the Vero Beach Police Department, where they stopped in to see Don before going to the Uptown. Don heard shouting in the hallway and walked out to see Tim glaring at his wife, Sandy. Tim seemed to be totally out of control, in a rage. Don had tried to stay out of their marital problems, but Tim had gone too far this time. So Don told him to leave. Tim left in a huff, peeling out of the parking lot. So Don followed Susan's car to the parking lot behind the lounge to make sure Tim wasn't stalking them. Within a couple of minutes, Tim came running towards Sandy, shouting, "Sandy, come home. You're supposed to be with me." Tim insisted that he had to talk with her. Made this huge scene. Don didn't want to arrest him, so he called another officer and asked him to keep an eye on Tim. Tim was a state trooper, so they wanted to keep the situation as low-key as possible. But if he tried anything violent, they were ready to take him in.
But Tim returned to that bar twice that night, and finally Sandy gave in and went home with him. He actually left the place with her in a headlock, but Sandy didn't want to get him fired from his job, so she just said, "It's okay, I'm just going to go with him." Now after that, Don went to his supervisor and explained his concerns about Tim because things were really getting out of control. Very worried about Sandy and the children. So the Florida Highway Patrol did know about the divorce and about Tim's out-of-line behavior. Also, his job performance was deteriorating. But it wasn't enough for them to find him unfit for duty, at least not yet. The Uptown incident had happened when he was off duty, and it was considered a domestic dispute. The supervisor decided to keep an eye on the situation, but they didn't take any disciplinary action against Tim Harris at this point.
So Tim did move out. Sandy wasn't taking him back.
Yep.
He planted tape recorders in the house after the move, and he taped all of Sandy's phone calls. He would also break into the upstairs of the house at night, climbing into the large outdoor dog pen, crawling into the kids' room, and sleeping there.
So that's pretty creepy. I don't think that would fly nowadays.
No.
Lorraine Hendricks, back to her, she left her home in Jacksonville at 8 a.m. on Sunday, March 4th. Now, she had a busy schedule, and she often drove too fast. She could be very impatient about getting where she needed to go. She'd had 8 speeding tickets in the previous 7 years. What she didn't know as she left for her trip on March 4th was that her license had already been suspended. Her notification was in the mail, but she hadn't gotten it yet. But that wasn't a huge deal because she could get it back. All she had to do was pay some speeding tickets. Lorraine's parents were babysitting her daughter, Catherine, and Lorraine called her dad from the road about 10 a.m. to ask how things were going, to talk to her little girl, and to tell her she'd be home the next day. After that, there were no more calls from Lorraine. Lorraine didn't show up as expected at her friend Carol's house in Fort Lauderdale that Sunday afternoon by 1 p.m., but Carol wasn't worried right away. She expected Lorraine to be a little late, and she had no phone in the house for Lorraine to call her on. But then by 3, Carol expected Lorraine to be there, and she was getting annoyed. It really wasn't like Lorraine to just blow her off and not show up. Lorraine's mom, Jody, called Carol about 5 o'clock to see if Lorraine was with her, and she wasn't. Lorraine's father called every highway patrol office along her path on the interstate, and none of the offices had any report on her. Then it was midnight, and no one had still heard from Lorraine, so people are getting worried.
Yeah, she didn't meet up with the real estate agent she was supposed to at 6 p.m., and she failed to keep her dental appointment the next morning, Monday. Her parents called everyone they could think of to see if they might have heard from Lorraine, but no one had. By Monday, March 5th, Lorraine was listed as a missing person in the state of Florida. Her physical description, the clothes she had worn, her birth date, and her home address were all on file. So Lorraine's family and friends tried to tell themselves that nothing could have happened to her on a sunny Sunday afternoon. She wouldn't have picked up a hitchhiker, and she had planned no stops between Jacksonville and Fort Lauderdale. If she had been in an accident, the highway patrol would know, and they would have notified her family.
Yeah, but then Lorraine's car was found. But they found no trace of Lorraine, or her purse, or her wallet, or her eyeglasses. Florida Highway Patrolman Mike Transu, whose patrol district included the same stretch of I-95 through Indian River and St. Lucie counties that Tim Harris worked, was on the day shift on that Monday. And he was the one who found her car. It was just before noon, and he saw the 1982 silver Honda Accord parked on the right shoulder of the southbound I-95. Transu pulled in behind the Honda and he walked around it, and there was no one in the car, but both of the front doors were unlocked. and there was a red briefcase, a 35mm camera, a blue and tan tote bag with expensive running shoes in it, a makeup bag, a watch, headphones, a red suitcase, and a blue windbreaker inside. Now, these were items that a passerby might steal, so he guessed that the car hadn't been there very long. It seemed that nothing was missing but the keys, purse, wallet, and of course Lorraine herself. Lorraine's soon-to-be ex-husband, Rick Hendricks, had the spare keys to the car. And after the car was towed, he came to the impound yard and he met with investigators. The car started without a problem, so that pretty much ruled out car trouble as the reason why she had parked on the side of the highway.
And investigators interviewed Rick and Lorraine's parents. They all said that Lorraine would never pick up a hitchhiker. She'd stop if she saw a turtle in the road and try to help it across the street, or she would stop for a police car. So on March 8th, during a search of a 3-mile area around where Lorraine's car had been found, Detective Phil Williams found Lorraine's body in a wooded section of the median. The medical examiner concluded that she had died by strangulation on March 4th. They found a fracture of the thyroid cartilage in the neck, a concealed hemorrhage deep in the neck tissues, and a contusion injury on the front of her left shoulder.
Also, someone had positioned her naked body so that her legs extended on either side of a pine tree, and she was face down, so the tree trunk rose like a creepy phallic symbol between her buttocks. She couldn't have fallen that way. Someone strong would have had to grab her by the feet and drag her backward until her genitals were up against the tree. So it really made it seem like it was some kind of sick sex crime.
Yeah, posing the body.
Yeah, very bad.
So Detective Phil Williams worked the case, and he kept thinking about Lorraine's family, saying that she'd only stop for a turtle or a cop. Could there be police involvement? It could have been a cop or someone dressed like a cop. Ted Bundy, Williams remembered, he used that technique effectively by identifying himself as a policeman before he lured his victims away from shopping malls or college campuses. All it took was a fake badge that pretty much anyone could buy.
And there were things in the case that went along with a cop or an ex-cop as the killer. The turnaround road through the Pine Woods median on I-95 was used pretty much exclusively by police. Very few civilians even knew that it was there. And also, Lorraine's license and registration were missing. Her wallet and credit cards had been found around the time they found her body. But there was no sign of her license or her car registration. And as you know, a driver's license and vehicle registration are the things a cop asks for when he pulls you over. So I think that was a big clue there.
It seems to be, right?
Yeah, definitely.
But if Lorraine had been stopped by a policeman, there wasn't any record of it. The only time Lorraine's plate had been run through the system was when Trooper Mike Transu entered it when he found her abandoned car on March 5th. So investigators looked at any warning tickets given out in that area on March 4th. And among the warning tickets turned into the Florida Highway Patrol was one that Trooper Tim Harris had written to a woman that we will call Laura at 10:48 in the morning on March 4th at State Road 9, which is not far from where Lorraine's car had been found.
So Sandy Harris had called Detective Williams. On March 24th, her estranged husband, Tim, had broken into her home and attacked her. He wanted to have sex with her, and he showed her that he was wearing black lace panties and pantyhose, and neither of these items belonged to Sandy. She felt certain that he was going to rape and kill her that night, but she agreed that they would get back together, and she somehow convinced him to leave the house that night. But now Sandy was terrified of Tim, and she was actually beginning to think he might be a killer. She took her kids and she went to stay with her sister Susan and her husband Don, and then she filed for a restraining order against Tim, which is probably something she should have done a long time ago before that.
Sure. So had she heard about this murdered, disappeared woman? She knew that police were investigating him?
Well, she didn't call about that, but I'm sure she had heard about it.
Yeah, because this is after this had all occurred.
Yes, but she didn't call to say she thought he'd done that.
No.
No.
She is worried for her own safety and her child's safety.
Yes. There are two children now because she had a son after she had Jennifer. She had a Tim Jr.
Oh.
So they actually had two kids by now. I forgot to mention him. Two little kids.
Two little kids.
Yeah.
Both named the way that Tim Harris wanted them named.
The way he'd planned before he even met Sandy. Yes.
So Detective Williams wondered why Tim Harris had stopped Laura for going only 5 miles over the speed limit. He located her at her home and asked her if she remembered being pulled over by Trooper Tim Harris. and boy, did she remember him.
He remembered it very well. She said that he stopped her for speeding, and she knew she wasn't speeding. She actually had a radar detector on that had not activated. He insisted that she was going 6 miles over the limit, and she knew that she was only going about 64 miles an hour in a 65-mile-an-hour zone. She said that the trooper who stopped her had a dog with him, and she'd been annoyed when he directed her to step out of her car and walk back toward his vehicle. But when she got out, this is when his attitude changed. She was very pregnant, it was obvious. And he might not have noticed that when she was in the car, but he couldn't miss it when she stepped out. So he told her that he had clocked her speed at 71 miles an hour and he wrote her a warning ticket. And that had irritated her. But then he said, which was odd, he said, "You can just throw that away, it doesn't mean anything." So she left that stop feeling very creeped out, like she'd just missed something horrible happening to her.
And she had.
Yes.
So she had been traveling alone, and she confided that she had been suspicious of the way the officer behaved. He had been polite and professional, but there was something about him that made her uneasy, and she had been quite upset by the encounter. She knew she wasn't speeding, and the trooper had to have known that too. It sounded as though she had been stopped when she wasn't speeding, and that Harris had only told her to tear up the ticket after he had her get out of the car and he could see she was pregnant. So that would definitely put some ice water in my veins, huh?
Yeah. So the detective, Detective Williams, wanted to talk to Tim Harris. And if Harris suspected that Williams was interested in talking to him about Lorraine Hendricks' murder, it was likely that he would be defensive. But if he thought that Williams was only investigating the domestic dispute with Sandy, Williams thought that would be easier. So that's what he was calling him up and mentioning. Sandy agreed to meet with Williams. Her complaint to the sheriff's office about Tim's attack on her was officially logged in as a battery. Sandy was terrified by what Tim had done to her, but she was even more afraid of her deep suspicion that Tim had done something more horrible than she could have imagined. Sandy told Williams that Tim had threatened to rape her several times while he had her pinned to the floor and handcuffed, and that he had also threatened to kill both of them with a gun if she didn't come back to him. Then she told the detective about the woman's undergarments that he had been wearing. She agreed to have a tape recorder attached to her phone at her office so that Tim's phone calls to her would be recorded. She had a restraining order against Tim, and she'd moved back into her house. But Tim did continue to be able to visit with their children.
Then Detective Williams interviewed Tim Harris, and Tim's version of the night of March 24th was very different from Sandy's. He insisted that Sandy had wanted a back rub, and that she enjoyed wrestling and playing around with the handcuffs. In his version, it had been Sandy who had kept luring him back home, and it was Sandy who had been suggesting sexual acts that she wanted to try. Now, Tim explained that he would do anything to get Sandy back, and he denied that he had brought any women's underwear to Sandy's house. Detective Williams checked with Lorraine Hendricks' friends and her estranged husband to see what kind of lingerie she usually wore. Lorraine had often wore black lace panties, but no one could identify the black panties left in Sandy Harris's home as definitely belonging to Lorraine. They were her size, but they were now stretched from being worn by a 200-pound man.
So Sandy had made a criminal complaint for the time Tim attacked her in the lace underwear, and he had handcuffed her so tightly that her wrists were black and purple. He was taken off the road, and he was given administrative duties. Detective Williams suspected him now of Lorraine's murder, but the police had been unable to find any physical evidence against him at all. When asked if he would take a polygraph, Tim said that he would. Knowing that Tim knew all of the polygraphers in the area, Williams asked him to pick which one he would like to have administer the test to him. Tim stalled, but then he did give permission for his squad car to be searched.
Now, whenever Williams got too close in discussions with Tim about Lorraine Hendricks' murder, Tim would dig in his heels, say he did not kill her, he did not stop her, he had never seen her. Tim said he had been looking for drug runners, and he definitely had not been out there looking for a single woman to stop. Tim agreed to take a polygraph, but on the day he was supposed to take it, he called Williams and said he had hired an attorney who advised him against it. So it had taken many calls to get Tim to come in and give an official statement. If he didn't confess to strangling Lorraine Hendricks, there is a good chance he's going to walk away, because without a confession, they really had nothing. Even with a confession, a conviction might not be a sure thing. However, the circumstantial evidence was accumulating, the search of Tim's patrol car had shown that he was a man preoccupied with sex. He was a guy who got off on the power that his uniform and his position gave him over women. They had found carbon copies of tickets where he'd written comments on female drivers' measurements, breast size, legs, and overall sexiness. Also, hidden among his possessions where he never thought anyone could find them were two cartoons. One looked as though it might have been Xerox, the kind of dirty joke that high school or junior high boys might pass around.
Well, the other one they thought that he had drawn himself. It was drawn in pencil on a pad, like a lined pad of paper. And this one showed a nude woman kneeling at a state patrolman's feet and asking, "Trooper Harris, are you sure I'm doing this right?" And the trooper answers, "Yes, this is the new breathalyzer test." So that's pretty gross.
It is.
That's something like a 12-year-old might...
Oh, no question.
Yeah. Not something you'd expect an adult man to be carrying around with him.
No. So the afternoon of Friday, April 6, 4 weeks after Phil Williams had discovered Lorraine Hendricks' body, Tim came to the state attorney's office for an interview, and he did not bring an attorney.
When asked about Sunday, March 4th, Tim recalled that he had set up his stationary radar near the wooded median, and this was between 10 and 11 a.m. He denied that he had ever gone down into the woods in the median. He said he'd just been there sitting, profiling drivers. He could see inside the cars coming at him enough to see how many people were inside, if they were black or white, male or female, if they had tinted glass in their windows. And he remembered the pregnant driver, Laura, and insisted that she was speeding. Tim said he had left the median strip area just 15 or 20 minutes after giving Laura the warning ticket. And the only ticket he had given that day was to a black man who was speeding into the high 90s. Tim said he had turned back north toward his brother David's house at the end of his shift, and he slept there that night, and then he had the next 2 days off.
So Williams turned the conversation back to the polygraph, and Tim said he just didn't want to take it. He said he'd taken one 8 years before when he applied for the patrol, and it had shown he was being deceptive about a time he'd been stopped by a policeman. He'd been telling the truth. The polygrapher had his driving record right there in front of him. But oddly, Tim's answer had come up that he was hiding something, so he hadn't trusted the polygraph ever since.
And Tim continued to deny killing Lorraine. But after the interview continued, he finally said that he had had consensual sex with her and that he had left the site before she did. When he left, he said she was fine, and now he felt horribly guilty that he didn't make sure she was safe and back in her car before he left. So we're getting one of these kind of gradual confessions.
We are.
Little by little.
Yeah, that's a bad move. You can't go changing your story. You know that.
I know that. Yes, I know that. But he killed somebody, so we're glad that he's confessing.
Right.
Tim went on to say that Lorraine wasn't stopped for speeding. He'd actually pulled her over for wearing headphones. And no one but the investigative team knew that Lorraine Hendricks routinely did listen to music through headphones while she drove. And no one else knew that they had found her headphones in the car either. That information had not been published in any paper. Tim said Lorraine Hendricks had been so starved for sex, though, that she had offered to have both intercourse and oral sex with him, because she said she hadn't had any in a while because she was getting divorced. The two of them had talked about their divorces, he said, and they agreed to have sex in the nearby woods. Tim said he had no idea why Lorraine's driver's license and registration were missing. He said he'd given them back to her right after he'd quickly looked at them. When asked about what had happened to Lorraine's warning ticket, he said he had thrown all of the copies away. So he left that day without confessing to murdering her. But he's definitely looking guilty at this point.
He sure is. He's coming around. Then a few days later, he was brought back in for another interrogation, and this time he caved. He admitted to killing Lorraine by strangling her with her own panties. He claimed that as he was beginning to have sex with Lorraine, he started thinking of her as Sandy, called her Sandy, and took out his rage at Sandy on Lorraine. He continued to insist that Lorraine had wanted to have sex with him. Now, nobody believed that scenario.
No. If Lorraine had been so willing to have sex with a complete stranger on the interstate, why had there been evidence in her autopsy that she had been beaten around her face and head? There was very rapid decomposition of her head compared to the rest of her body, and according to the ME, that suggested that she had suffered severe trauma to her face, like in a beating. The investigators believed that Tim Harris had punched Lorraine to make her do what he wanted. So he had raped her, of course.
Yes. So Tim was arrested and did a little perp walk past the other state troopers in his handcuffs. Now, most of them were shocked to see the previously meticulous trooper being locked up for murder. Lorraine's car had been found with both front doors unlocked and her belongings still inside, including a briefcase with important papers. Everyone who knew her well said she had been a cautious woman. She never would have left her car unlocked, especially not with her things inside. The only way Lorraine would have walked away from her unlocked car would have been if Tim Harris had asked her to step back to his patrol car for a moment. This is fairly standard procedure in Florida. The officers have the driver sit in the patrol unit while they have the dispatcher check wants and warrants and while they write tickets. Lorraine might have complied with this request, thinking she'd be back in her car in a few minutes. Common sense said that she would never have left her car unlocked and willingly accompany a stranger down into the dark woods for sex.
Now, I've been pulled over and I've never been asked to get out of the car, I don't think. Definitely not to get in the squad car.
No.
So that's odd to me, but I guess it's something that they did at least back in the 80s.
They might have.
But Lorraine hadn't been hard up for sex. She had this new lover who she was crazy about. So just the whole idea that she would have done that is preposterous to me. Detective Williams had talked to almost everyone who cared about Lorraine, and they said that she was in a serious relationship and she had never been interested in casual sex.
A public defender was appointed to Tim Harris to defend him on charges of first-degree murder, and the state of Florida was seeking the death penalty. So the trial was set for October of 1990. In September, the defense lost on a major point. The public defender's main defense strategy was that Tim had been coerced into confessing. More than anything, he wanted Tim's taped statements to Detective Williams and his confession to state attorney Bruce Colton kept out of his trial. But the tapes would be allowed in for a jury to hear.
But in the end, there was no murder trial. On Friday, September 28, 1990, Tim admitted that he had killed Lorraine Hendricks. He was allowed to plead not guilty to murder, but he did plead no contest to the first-degree murder charges. That saved him from the electric chair, but he was sentenced to life in prison. Then he was sent to live out the rest of his life at the Baker Correctional Institution in Alusti, Florida.
In the days after his arrest, more than 30 people, most of them women, called the Fort Pierce office asking what to do if they are afraid to stop for a trooper, especially in an isolated area. The callers were told to slow down, acknowledge the trooper's presence by waving, and drive at a safe speed to the nearest populated area. The motorists were also told they had the right to ask a trooper to call for another officer. There were more than 1,500 troopers in the state trying to do their job with the greatest amount of integrity. Brevard County Sheriff Jake Miller instructed his deputies to be tolerant of motorists who might be leery and might want to drive to a populated area before stopping. But Miller also said that motorists should use common sense and not overreact out of fear.
So well, how do you feel about this?
Well, I just think that's a dumb way to put it to begin with. On the one hand, he's saying, drive slowly, get to a populated area. And then he's saying, don't overreact. I mean, those...
Well, don't speed off.
Those contradict each other.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I did have an incident like this back in the 90s where I was being pulled over, but I was afraid to pull over because it was dark out, and I drove for quite a ways with the police car.
Yeah.
And they were getting quite alarmed why I wouldn't pull over, and I think I overdid it.
Maybe.
Because when they finally pulled over, they had their guns drawn. So I think that might be what he means by overreact. But I'd seen something on the Oprah show that said, you know, there was a policeman doing this and you shouldn't pull over for him. So I was waiting till I got to an exit, but unfortunately it was several miles.
Yeah.
So I can kind of understand it though. Oh, you do have to be careful.
I can understand, but try to mitigate it by saying don't react because you're afraid.
Well,
true. Or overreact. I mean, geez.
Yeah.
If you just acknowledge that we have this difficulty and that we're going to make sure that we do our utmost to patrol the areas as we're supposed to and not harm people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, one thing you can also do is you can call 911 from your car and say, can you check that it's really a policeman pulling me over? Now that we have cell phones all the time. So.
Well, now you can.
Yeah, this was back before cell phones.
Back in the mid to late 80s.
Okay. On February 16th of 1992, Lorraine's husband, Rick Hendricks, filed a wrongful death suit against the state of Florida and the Department of Highway Safety and Motor Vehicles. Now, Hendricks said that the Florida Highway Patrol failed to discover the fact that Harris had been asked to resign from another agency for improper conduct, and that Harris had exhibited a pattern of socially deviant behavior, demonstrating that he was psychologically unfit to be a highway trooper assigned to road patrol duty. And the suit was heard in the last week of February of 94, so it took a couple years. And Hendricks testified about their daughter Catherine's heartbreaking reaction as he told her that her mother had died. Attorneys for Lorraine and Catherine's estates elicited information from an expert witness that the estates had lost between $588,000 and $898,000 in projected wages and household support when Lorraine was murdered. Lawyers for the Hendricks family asked for $3 million for Catherine's pain, suffering, and loss also. For the Hendricks family to win, though, they would have had to prove that the state was liable and had been able to foresee what Tim Harris was going to do. The six jurors would have to believe that the Florida Highway Patrol's failure to act was the cause of Lorraine Hendricks' murder. So the jurors found that the Florida Highway Patrol was not liable for having Trooper Harris on the road patrol. So they didn't get anything in the lawsuit. Do you agree with that?
I think it would have been a tough suit to win.
Yeah, I think you're right. But I think that the earlier places that he worked for maybe shouldn't have given him a recommendation.
Well, that, or if they had been able to find records from the Melbourne Village Police that showed he had been terminated.
Well, they gave him a chance to resign, right?
Right.
Yeah.
But there should be notes about that. Who knows how public all this stuff was about his behavior with his wife. I mean, she was a private person. She didn't tell her parents all the stuff he was doing to her. She right. probably didn't even tell her sister.
Yeah, and the big event with the wife didn't happen until after Lorraine had already been murdered.
Yeah.
And he had already been taken off the road by then.
Right. So again, it would have been a tough one.
It would have. It's just incredibly sad that this happened.
It certainly is.
So there really isn't a ton of information out there on this case. There are a good series of articles in the Orlando Sun paper, which you can find online. And also Anne Rule wrote a story on this case in one of her books. It's one of those books that has more than one crime in them. And the book's called You Belong to Me. So I'll put a link to that book in our show notes in case anyone is interested in reading that.
And just a quick reminder, we have lots of True Crime Brewery merchandise available. If you click on Shop the Brewery on our website, tiegrabber.com, you can click on our TeePublic link to get your summer t-shirts, tank tops with your choice of True Crime Brewery designs, colors, and sizes. They also have phone cases, hoodies, mugs, pillows, just about everything. You name it. It's worth a look.
I think my favorite is the lightweight hoodie, because you know how a lot of hoodies are real bulky? But the lightweight hoodie is just perfect. I really enjoy that shirt. I wear it a lot.
For this cool spring weather?
Perfect, right? Yep. It's for a summer night, anytime when there's just a little nip in the air, it's not too warm.
Right.
Our music for True Crime Brewery was written and produced by Tristan Capel. Just a quick reminder about Team Tie Grabber. It's a way for you to give support to the podcast and get an extra episode each month. As soon as you join, you receive an email with login information and a link that allows you to add our members-only show to your podcast app. Then, of course, you will have access to all of our past members-only episodes, in addition to each new one when they come out. In March, we covered the case of Robert Reldan, a real charmer who was actually a real monster, a rapist and a murderer, who was actually enabled, we believe, by his good looks and by his wealthy family. This month, we're covering an Alaska case, the case of Lori Waterman. Lori was brutally murdered by two men who were friends, maybe both were lovers or one was a lover, of her teen daughter. Now the daughter, Rochelle, had apparently told these guys that her mother was abusing her. And why they decided that murder was the solution, I can only guess it's because they were idiots. Cruel idiots, I guess. Still, the punishment, or rather lack of punishment, that Rochelle Waterman received defies reason to me, and it's quite outrageous, so you might enjoy our discussion on that case. One more thing, if you have a few minutes to spare, we would greatly appreciate it if you could leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you listen. More positive reviews help us find more people to listen to our podcast, which is a good thing. So let's move on to feedback now. I don't want to beg or sound desperate, but we would love to get more voicemails. To leave a voicemail with your comments or case suggestions, just click on Leave a Voicemail on our website, tiegrabber.com. And of course, we also love to get your comments and your suggestions in emails or social media messages too. Another way to communicate with us and other listeners is to join our True Crime Brewery fan discussions group on Facebook. Lots of interesting things going on there all the time. So we're going to move on to feedback, and since I've just mentioned our fan discussion page, there is something recently that's come up on there, and it's regarding a missing child that we did a case on, I'd say over a year ago, Timothy Pitson.
At least over a year.
Yeah.
Maybe closer to two.
Been a while, and we just kind of assumed that Timothy was dead, but now there's a chance that he might be alive. He might have been found. Actually, we're waiting today for DNA results to show whether this boy is Timothy Pitson.
He's identifying himself as Timothy Pitson, right?
Yeah, a 14-year-old boy says he's Timothy Pitson, and he's just escaped from two kidnappers that have been holding him for 7 years. He's originally from Illinois and was last known to be with his mother, who had killed herself, apparently. And a note was left saying that Timothy was with someone, but he was safe, but he would never be found. So yesterday, this 14-year-old described the two kidnappers that he had been with as two male white bodybuilder types. One had black curly hair, a Mountain Dew shirt and jeans, and a spiderweb tattoo on his neck. The other was short in stature and had a snake tattoo on his arms. The vehicle they were operating is described as a newer model Ford SUV bearing Wisconsin plates with a second row white in color and yellow transfer paint and a dent on the left back bumper. So apparently he said that he escaped and kept running across the bridge into Kentucky. They had been staying at a Red Roof Inn, but Timothy had no idea where. So the county dispatch had contacted all surrounding agencies with a Red Roof Inn in their jurisdiction, and they're checking out the motels, but they haven't found anything. So residents in a Newport, Kentucky neighborhood just across the Ohio River from Cincinnati called police after this boy was found wandering the streets. He'd actually approached a woman in a vehicle and asked for help. She said he looked dirty and confused with bruises on his face. Now, he went missing in 2011. He was just 6 years old, so now he would be 14. Of course, by the time people hear this podcast, they'll know. We don't know. Hopefully by this evening, they should know if it's him or not.
It'd be nice that he wasn't killed.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm saying.
I don't think it's probably going to be nice if he is that kid who's been held in captivity for 7, 8 years.
Well, yeah, he might have gone through a lot of bad stuff.
He might have.
But I think it's amazing that he could be alive. I remember doing that case and feeling pretty certain that his mother had killed him.
Yes, we did.
So I hope that's wrong.
We'll see.
Okay. So do we have any voicemails today?
We have a voicemail. This is from Rona. She has some comments that she makes and a case suggestion.
Hi, my name is Rona. I'm Scottish, and I just wanted to say that I really like podcasts. I really love it. I love the way that you set everything up, Jill, so that you get right into the story. Right into the nitty-gritty of everything, and Dick's opinions are always quite on point, I have to say. I really do love everything that you do with it. I go walking. Unfortunately, I have battling cancer at the minute, so I've been told by my doctor that I really need to go walking as much as possible, so you're usually in my ears, and that's where I sort of get into everything, and I'm kind of lost in the story, you know. What else I wanted to say? I wanted to say that just that I love it, and I really like beer reviews too. I'm a beer drinker myself. I do like some craft beers too, so I'm hoping that when I'm better, I can try some of the beers that you suggest. It'd be difficult with some of them because obviously where I am, obviously in Scotland, we don't have access to the same kind of beers. But usually we do have some craft ones, we have some craft Scottish ones too, which are really quite good. I've been to Beer Miscuous in Boston, which does the craft ones, and is really a really good place to go if you're ever in Boston, you guys. I think that was all I really wanted to say. Oh, I had a suggestion. I'd love to hear your take on Bible John. It's a Glasgow based one, which is closest to me, so I would really like to hear your take on that. It's not been solved case either, so there's a few different suspects, so I'd love to hear what you think, if it's who it could be. So I'll sign off now, but just to say, keep up the good work. Thanks, guys. Bye.
Well, thank you, Rona.
Yes, thank you. Those are nice comments.
They are, and I'm a cancer survivor, so I wish you better days ahead.
We do. So I looked up Bible John. There's actually quite a bit written about him. There's several books, actually.
Is that somebody's name?
Well, that's what they've called him. He's an unidentified serial killer.
Oh, I see. All right.
He's believed to have murdered three young women between 1968 and 1969 in Glasgow.
Oh, a historic case. I like that.
Now, each of the victims of Bible John were young brunette women between the ages of 25 and 32, and they all had met their murderer at the Barrowland Ballroom, which was a dance hall and music venue in the city. The perpetrator has never been identified, and the case remains unsolved, despite one of the most extensive manhunts in Scottish criminal history. Murders committed by Bible John would prove to be the first time in Scotland in which the Crown Office authorized the publication of a composite drawing of an individual suspected of murder for public viewing.
Hmm.
And he was known as Bible John because he was repeatedly quoting from the Bible and to have condemned any form of adultery while in the company of his final victim. The known movements and modus operandi of convicted serial killer and rapist Peter Tobin have led to suggestions that he might have been responsible.
Okay.
So we're going to study some more.
Okay, I think we have done one Scottish case a long time ago.
We might have.
But that's it.
If we have done it. Your memory's better than mine.
Well, wasn't the father who was killing his children, wasn't he in Scotland? The Munchausen father?
Oh, yeah.
I think he was.
That's true.
Can't remember the name of it, but yeah.
Okay.
Anyway, lovely accent, too. Thank you for the voicemail.
So that's it for voicemails.
All right. So we do need more voicemails if anybody has anything.
I've got some interesting emails.
Okay. Let's do those.
First one's from Nina. She has a case suggestion.
Okay. Nina wrote, "Hi, guys. I'm writing you with a bit of an unusual request. I realize that you must be swamped with case requests, so I appreciate any help you can give. This case takes place in 1960 in Massachusetts. It involves a young wife and mother of two who vanished one day and hasn't been found since. Her name is Joan Risch. There is a lot about her on the web, but I was hoping maybe you had more resources to dig further. Joan's husband, Martin, never remarried, lived in the same house, and kept the same phone number in case Joan ever tried to reach him or came home. He's gone now, never knowing what happened to his wife. But his children, who were only 4 and 2 years of age respectively then, are now in their early 60s and deserve answers. This case has touched me. I can't imagine having my loved one missing for so long and getting no resolution. There is still time for her children, but that window is closing fast as well. Her son, David, seems to have had a particularly hard life and entered a nursing home really young, in his 50s. I'm not sure if it has to do with his mom missing, as he was only 2 when it happened, so he couldn't remember much about that day. The case is still open, so I appreciate any help you can offer. Sincerely, Nina."
So this, you talked about vintage cases. This is a little older. It's from 1961.
Yes.
And police went to a house in Lincoln, Massachusetts after a neighbor reported seeing blood leading from the house to the driveway. She made the discovery after a young girl living in the house had returned from a play date to find her mother, Joan Risch, missing. Several unconfirmed sightings of an apparently disoriented Risch walking on nearby roads later that day were reported. Blood matching Risch's type was found smeared in the kitchen. There is other evidence suggesting that she might have been abducted, although at the time her 2-year-old son was safely asleep in his room. Then later it was discovered that Risch had borrowed several library books about murders and disappearances, including one with similarities to her own case. So this obviously led to speculation that she had staged her own disappearance.
Huh.
Evidence was later discovered of a troubled past which may have motivated such a scheme. And there's other theories suggesting that Joan Risch suffered an accident on the nearby construction site for the Massachusetts Route 128 freeway, and she's buried under concrete somewhere there. The case remains unsolved.
All right. See? Let's see if we can find more on that.
2 cases, 2 unsolved mysteries.
Very good. I'd like to look into that one. Our next email is from Haley, and it's a case suggestion. This is the honor killing of Yaswinder Kaur Sidhu. How badly did I slaughter that name?
Sounds good to me.
Well, you probably don't know much better than I.
I was going to say that.
Okay. All right. But anyway, this was someone who was killed in June of 2000. An Indo-Canadian beautician who was murdered in an honor killing. She was kidnapped, tortured, and killed on the orders of her mother and her uncle. That just blows me away.
Yeah, and I think we have a book on that, too. That was a very, very, very brief synopsis. She grew up in Canada and worked in Canada as a beautician, as you said, and travels back to India, fell in love with a guy who was the wrong guy. This was not the person that her mother wanted her to marry. She went and married him and then was living in Canada while her husband was in India. Her mother basically had her imprisoned in her house. She escaped, returned to India to be reunited with her husband. They were both captured by people in India. He was beaten. She was tortured and killed. And then there was this whole deal about extradition of the mother to India for charges. It's a mess.
Wow.
Interesting case. So
right.
I want to look into that.
And you said you bought a book about that?
I'm going to.
Okay, good. Our next case suggestion is from an unnamed person.
Yeah, this person wrote to ask about looking at a murder. She didn't want her name or any information spoken of.
Okay.
So we didn't. She wanted the murder of Roy Schutzler by Rosemary van der Kar to be investigated.
So what happened here?
So this is a, I'm going to condense this for you. So this is about a guy named Roy Schutzler, who was a longtime resident of Las Vegas, whose wife had died. And he was taken up with Rosemary van der Kar, and she was sentenced for strangling him and killing him. And her son was supposed to be a helper in the murder.
So is this for money?
I believe.
Okay, so it's very unusual for a woman to strangle a man, isn't it?
Sure is. That's why I wanted to look at that.
So they said that this woman had a pretty disturbing affect about her.
Yeah, she's kind of crazy. So she was found guilty, think of second-degree murder. Anyway, she was sentenced to life in prison with the possibility of parole. But then Nevada, where the crime occurred, has another thing called age enhancement. So if you kill someone over age of 60, that's a second charge. So she got another 20 years in prison for the age enhancement.
So she's pretty much in prison for life then?
Most likely.
Okay. That's interesting. I've never heard of the age enhancement.
Me either. I thought that was fascinating.
So that's just because they're thinking if you're over 60, you're more vulnerable.
I think so.
Well, I have heard of laws similar to that about children, if you kill a young child, right? We've heard that.
Oh, we have, yes.
Yeah.
About time someone's looking out for us seniors.
I know, it's rough. So we also have a case suggestion from Tammy. Tammy wrote, "Hi, Jill and Dick. I want to reach out and tell you what a huge fan I am becoming. The more I hear, the more I love you, too. Your empathy and kindness in telling horrific stories and keeping it completely human is wonderful. Keep up the great work. I'm going to add to your growing list of case suggestions the murder of Lori Show in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, on December 20th, 1991. There was a group of teenagers, one of them was pregnant, who killed Lori. I've been listening to all different true crime podcasts, and I have yet to hear this story featured. I would love to hear your take on the case. Thanks again for great content and making my workday fly by." Thank you, Tammy.
Nice letter.
Yeah, very nice. So the murder of Lori Show. What do we know about this other than what she told us?
Well, Lori was murdered in 1991. She was a 16-year-old sophomore in high school. Her body was discovered in her home by her mother, Hazel.
Oh, no.
Her throat had been cut and she had been beaten. Classmates Lisa Michelle Lambert, Tabitha Buck, and Lawrence Yunkin were charged with her murder.
So this is kind of a mean girls type of thing, which we've done a few of those cases in the past. I think we've done three that are similar.
Well, and there's a complicated love triangle also.
Yeah.
So, and there's a lot to talk about. So write that down too.
Good suggestion.
Yeah.
The list is getting long.
We've got some good suggestions.
We do. I appreciate it. Well, thank you, everyone, for your suggestions. Do you have anything to add, Dickie?
No, I mean, it seems like we've done a few cases recently where there are warning signs galore that the murderer shouldn't be allowed to be doing what he was doing.
And I know. What do we do about that, though?
I
mean, really, it's a tough one.
Exactly.
Because we were talking last week, we had someone write into feedback about Swango and another doctor from the Dr. Death podcast, which I haven't listened to yet. So we were talking about how physicians, how a lot of what they do gets covered up and how they can get away with a lot. Now we're talking about a policeman.
Yep.
So It's just scary, because you really do put your trust in a policeman pulls you over on a dark road at night. You're
believing that they're just a policeman.
Yeah. You have to trust them.
Yep.
So it's scary.
Certainly is.
Yeah.
All right, guys. See you next time.
All right. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and we will see you next time at the Quiet End. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.